Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's always good to have old friends on the show, especially old friends who you got to start with by having an argument, and you're still friends with them over 30 years later. By course, I'm referring to director Edward Zwick, who's had a bent for making films. If they weren't based on real-life events, they could be, going back to Special Bullets in his TV film, to Glory, to Love and Other Drugs, to Defiance, to the terrific film that you should see, Pawn Sacrifice. His newest film is Trial by Fire. Ed, it's always so good to have you here.
It's good to be here.
And it is this thing that you are often attracted to a piece of material that's based in the real world in some way.
If not on the people, then certainly on the issues.
Yeah, and what is that for you?
I don't know. I mean, I guess I have some background. I began in journalism long, long ago, and I think there's always been some wish to be part of the conversation.
Or to compel the conversation, it feels like, in some ways, doesn't
it? Be provocative in it.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like you are using movies in that great old-fashioned way, going back to almost the old Warner Brothers films, stuff like I Was a Fugitive from a Chain Gang, or this, like, the idea that film can provoke conversation and still connect to the real world and still be dramatic.
Well, yeah, and that happened long before films. There was a strand, you know, in American letters that believed that was one of the roles of the artist and particularly the author.
Certainly about Trial by Fire, which is such an interesting piece because so much of your work is about either literal guilt or metaphorical guilt. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think about Defiance, the guilt of those guys who try to save people, mm-hmm. or the guilt of Robert Shaw in Glory, mm-hmm. Or in this case, a situation where there's actual question of guilt or innocence,
mm-hmm.
isn't there?
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. I hadn't thought of that connective tissue, but I certainly know that we all have been in that situation, even as children, when you've been falsely accused of taking your sister's candy bar, or of much worse, and there's a way that we understand, I think, the nature of injustice, and I think that's a word that's become very important in the culture right about now.
Well, talk a little bit about Trial for the audience, what the film's about.
Yeah, well, it's the story of a disreputable young guy in Corsicana, Texas, who's a heavy metal drug user and, you know, kind of he's had some trouble with the law.
On the face of it, a bad guy.
A bad guy, the kind of person that society inevitably and very quickly deems to be the other. And so when there's a fire in his house that takes the lives of his three young children, he's accused immediately by virtue of this junk science, this arson science, of a triple murder. And he's put on trial in Corsicana, Texas. The jury is out for 45 minutes. He's represented – he's barely represented by his defense. And he is put on death row immediately. And it is one of those cases in which everybody needed to find some explanation to the monstrosity of this tragedy. And he was it, because he's the thing we don't want to have in our midst. And so they put him on death row. And there he lingers, trying to find his way toward appeals, knowing that he's not going to get any. And because, just parenthetically, you know that it's better to be rich and guilty than to be poor and innocent, in terms of particularly the criminal
or
justice
system.
Or the other. Of any kind.
Yes.
And just in this weird set of coincidences, a woman, a housewife, mother of two, a playwright, a woman named Elizabeth Gilbert, interestingly enough, is asked if she would correspond with someone on death row. And at a crossroads in her life, and almost on a whim, she agrees. And they begin this correspondence, which leads her to visit him. And, you know, there are those stories of those sort of jailhouse romances. This becomes something deeper, something very, very intense between them.
It's kind of a philosophical romance, isn't it?
It is, actually, platonic in that way, in the truest sense of what that means. And really becomes for both of them this transitional moment and a very important moment of change in both their lives that leads them to places they had not expected, each of them. And it's the story of that relationship, the transcendence of it, but it's also a story about it's about the industry of the death penalty in America and particularly in the state of Texas.
Yes, exactly that. And it's interesting, too, because this film is also kind of about that. What you've so often done is to take an epic story mm-hmm. and to tell it in the most intimate terms. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, do you attract it because of that? Because it lent itself to that.
Yeah, I agree. And I think always, it's funny, when you have this kind of larger canvas, the issues or the epic scale that you're talking about, or epic in terms of ideas, because this is not epic in scale, certainly.
But it's a story. It's an epic story, certainly.
It is.
It's a story about epic circumstances.
That's right. And when you juxtapose a personal story against that, it takes away the need to pump a kind of artificiality into the drama. The drama exists for free because these people are in that circumstance. So the intensity of their relationship and the pitch at which it takes place is just there. And it gives it lends something to the actors and to the performances and to each scene that you don't have to somehow pump up. And I think that becomes a very interesting way in which the story is both large and small simultaneously.
Sure, because so many of these stories you do, it finally becomes about relationships, about lonely people trying to connect.
That's right.
And we can say, gosh, I mean, Blood Diamond, or so many of these films mm-hmm. are about lonely people trying to find a way to connect to somebody else in the midst of a bigger story.
That's right. And how this random act of kindness, anybody's random act of kindness, in fact, can then yield this very significant change for both of them.
We're getting a little epistemological here with my guest, Ed Zwick. His new film as director is Trial by Fire. But I think what's happening so often in these films is that idea of the story, the smaller story being told inside of a bigger story. And it becomes so much for you, it's got to be about brushing away, for example, the coverage of this thing, which was basically a kind of a trial in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
And getting to the heart of the people in the middle of that story as it's unfolding.
Yeah, I think finally, I'm not interested in doing something that is polemical. I think the polemics and the politics of it will resonate inevitably because of the context. I think we go to the movies so as to relate to those relationships and to invest in them. And I think in this case, particularly to invest in the very unlikely protagonist.
And also to really not offer – to not – in effect make the movie a trial, but to offer up that story rather than telling us about –
Well, that's a very interesting way to talk about it, because I felt that when you see the movie – I've talked to audiences now and seen them. Their reaction to what happens is very much the same reaction as the people of Corsicana, Texas. They indict him immediately. Their experience of what happens becomes Elizabeth Gilbert's experience as they come to see him.
We should say
that
in the first third, he's kind of indicted by everybody around him.
Absolutely. And so, but as you watch that change, you participate in their process. And you too, as I think in the audience, feel complicit in the process. At least that's what people have said.
Yeah, so I guess in my clumsy way trying to get to this kind of social, cultural maelstrom that's going on around these figures mm-hmm. leads to judgment about the circumstance rather than judging the people in the middle of it.
That's right. Yeah, and I also think that it's part of something that seems to be happening in a lot of other areas where the trope used to be crime and punishment. I think there's a different trope that if you think about Serial as a for instance and other things and these podcasts since then and a lot of things on Netflix, these documentaries, it's crime and innocence, an examination of the system itself as being broken, as being flawed. And I think the injustice of this particular moment is being examined in a way that a lot of artists are being drawn to.
It's interesting though, because this has been something that it's kind of always been a go-to for you, the idea of this kind of inexorable institution exacting its toll.
Mm-hmm. I think that's true.
I was going to ask you if it was a matter of ego in some of these cases, because so often in this loneliness is...
My ego or the
characters? No, the protagonist. We'll get to your ego later. But there's almost this kind of cri de coeur from the people in the center of these stories, isn't there?
Uh-huh. Yeah. I think, well, gosh, there's a tradition that I know I've always responded to of a hero understanding that though those odds may be impossible, nonetheless, there is meaning in that struggle. And I think that's her case in this particular story.
I guess it's so interesting for me to talk to you about this, as we have over the years about this. And so often, again, in the midst of a much bigger story, it's about really about two people and a relationship, and almost always not conventionally romantic.
Right.
And as often as not conventionally romantic. And I wonder if that becomes for you kind of one of the flagpoles that you end up responding to.
Huh. I always like it when you tell me things about myself that I don't know, and I wonder if I should pay you for this session.
Be nice if somebody did, but no. That ideal actually of a kind of a philosophical or platonic relationship happening so often in these works, a kind of conversation where people are trying to work out who and what they are in the midst of what's going on around them, and that becomes it sets in effect two different dramas into motion.
Yeah, I guess the obvious way to do it in the context of a romance, I think, would take away from the – I think it would be oddly conciliatory. I think it would be –
Do you think so? Because I just wonder if there's a thing – because we know –
I don't know. In Casablanca, do we think about the Free French, or do we think about Ingrid Bergman and Humphrey Bogart? We think about them kissing. You know, I think there's something.
But there's a literal romance taking place at the heart of that, thwarted romance, but romance nonetheless. And these things that you've done, it's been about sort of the romance of ideas, really.
That's right.
Whether there's somebody who can articulate
it. I guess it's less wet that way. In some way, I think it feels a little bit.
Is it an aesthetic quality that you respond to, do you think?
Unconsciously, maybe. I hadn't really thought about it till this very second, but I know it's true.
Because it's almost, and we've kind of had this conversation in a way since I've known you, you're a contrarian and you want to sort of thwart any, I don't know how conscious it is for you, wanting to thwart audience expectations a little bit, and by sort of catching them off guard, pulling them deeper into the story.
Well, if an audience knows exactly what's going to happen, I think they're then guarded against the effects of what happens. And I think if they are caught off by surprise, I think they lean in. I think their attention is more engaged. And I am interested in certain ways to find certain expectations. And I think that, you know, I believe in the use of genre, because there is the genre of the trial movie or the prison romance, or in Glory, it's about this plucky group of guys getting together to take that hill, and that's the World War II platoon movie. And I think in Blood Diamond, I think you can see Tony Curtis and Sidney Poitier in that genre. I mean, there are genre is necessary because it gives you an armature of a story that an audience can understand or feel comfortable with. But once you have that, I think it's much more interesting to me to find a more skewed or more parallax way to tell it.
I guess the part of that becomes about the way of, again, seducing the audience with the mechanism of genre.
Right.
And then offering them something that they weren't looking for.
That's right.
In that context, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, genre is comforting. Like all the classical forms are comforting. We know them, and the minute we hear the music changing, I remember when my daughter was four, she would say, "Oh, well, the bad guy's coming now," because she'd hear the change in the score, you know. And we're taught, and we're, by the way, you know, narrative is the way by which we understand the world. We're taught narrative, not just with children's stories, but advertising is narrative, and psychology is narrative, and everything is done in that way. So we cleave to the obligatories of narrative in a way that is comforting. But I think it's good to be a little discomfited then and wrong-footed. And that's delightful, I think, when you're surprised.
We're going to take a little break here. My guest is director Edward Zwick. His new film is Director's Trial by Fire. It's the treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? Critics rave The Greatest Hits is a music-infused romance that hits all the right notes and the most original time travel story in years. Featuring music by Nelly Furtado, Beach House, Jamie XX, and more. Watch The Greatest Hits, now streaming on Hulu.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. It's the treatment. I'm having the same argument with my guest, Edward Zwick. I've been having with him for the last 30 years. This time it's in the case of his newest film, Trial by Fire. I think, though, that if you feel it's incumbent on you to also find a way to engage the expectation the audience has of a movie star and to sort of say, I can use that persona, that charisma, that power to take you someplace you don't expect to go.
Absolutely. I think that's true. I like to think that I cast movie stars as actors. I like to think that I challenge them to do something that we may not have seen them. But you're right. There is something that's intrinsic in that charisma that makes the story and even their presence larger. You know, it's funny. Somebody who was really lovely to me in the beginning of my career was Sidney Pollack. And he did that often, in fact, even starting with They Shoot Horses, I think, and other movies. And a lot of times it worked really well and sometimes less well. But I think that when you talk about comfort and trying to, if you're telling a story that is as difficult as this story is and that is, it's emotionally taxing, I think that you want to feel like you're in good hands. And one of the things that a movie star gives you by virtue of what their career has been or the experiences you've had with them or how you've identified with them in a certain part is a certain amount of comfort. And so to have someone like Laura, who has been so vivid and so available and I think has come to a whole generation of people with a set of expectations that you're going to identify with her vulnerability, and yet
you're talking about Laura Dern here.
Yeah, I'm talking about Laura Dern. Yeah, and I think that's a way in for an audience to a circumstance that they might not otherwise have been willing to go.
I guess I don't mean to keep going back to this, well, but I just think it's really interesting because if you came up. And we're roughly the same age, seeing the movies of the 50s and 60s, mm-hmm. kind of romanticized movie stars, mm-hmm. and maybe were in some ways, when we look back now, were more subversive than we thought, but on mm-hmm. the face of it, were fairly superficial in terms of the demands made of these people. And often they were star vehicles, the stars sort of beat into what they want them to be.
Right.
Your career has been, in effect, a kind of response to that.
Well, I can think of a lot of performances by actors that, whether they're, you know, the best work they've done, it is sometimes the more unique work that they've done. And I don't know, I think that I find that is a thing that they've wanted to do, and that's part of the appeal, and it's something that I've also wanted to do. I think that it actually, it's funny, I'm thinking about something very different, but often when working with writers, or even myself, but to see something that is latent in a writer and then as if I were an editor at some magazine teasing that out and making it manifest. I think it's the same thing with an actor. I think there are aspects of an actor's instrument that may not necessarily have always been understood to be there. And if I can see that, identify that, and if I can encourage that, then what comes out is a whole other part of their who they are on screen at the same time as what you already have.
It's interesting, too, because I was going to bring this up, and I'm glad you did. In the last few years, you've been working with scripts from other writers.
Uh-huh.
And I wonder if that was something you just felt like at this point in your life you wanted to try to do that just because it makes a form more openly collaborative for you, and it becomes finding another voice and, in effect, bring this conversation that the movies have into your creative life.
Yeah, and I think it's true. I mean, first of all, they're wonderful writers. Stephen Knight is a great writer, and Jeffrey Fletcher is a great writer. And, you know, I end up getting everything that they've brought and then whatever else I can then bring to it as well. And so my function is interpretive as much as it's seminal, and that's really kind of great. But particularly this movie – it was very interesting for me, and things that Jack O'Connell does, which are really marvelous. There's a good deal of improvisation in this movie.
Really?
Yeah. When he's on that death row, some of the conversations between him and Laura, we worked together in a very interesting way. And I think a legacy of the first time I was able, not able, first time I worked digitally, because you're able to just let's keep running. Let's see what happens. You know, when he's in that cell and he's in solitary, it was a real challenge directorially and for the actor to say, what does solitary feel like? And the only way to get it to for him to get there is to be in that cell, sometimes for half an hour at a time or even an hour at a time, and just roll. And that's the kind of thing you can never do as an actor, certainly in a film where you're trying to break it up into little discrete bits of, you know, 30 seconds and 3-minute takes. And we reach some interesting places that way.
Because I guess I found myself thinking, too, in terms of working with other writers, there are writers who work, I would think, from much different places psychologically than you do.
Mm-hmm.
And having that conversation allows you to bring something new to your work.
You bet.
And there's got to be a certain point of hunger for that, isn't there?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, it's not as if I won't write something again and do it, I hope. And it's just, I guess I know what I know. And I'm sort of interested in what I don't.
Well, we're talking about The Unknown with my guest, Edward Zwick, whose new film is, as director, is Trial by Fire, is The Treatment. But it's so interesting because in talking about loneliness, you brought it back to seeing Jack by himself,
mm-hmm.
and what that just does to him, and just watching the way his body changes,
mm-hmm.
overall, just his posture when he realizes that there's nobody looking at him.
Yeah.
I mean, that's got to be an enormously difficult thing to get an actor to do, to make himself that open and that vulnerable, that much of a raw nerve.
And sometimes technology, you know, has an effect on content. When you can have a little camera in a space with very little light and no one else around, and if you can disappear even, that's affording an actor an extraordinary opportunity.
I want to talk a little bit, because we didn't have you here for Pawn Sacrifice, which I enjoyed a lot. And a lot of things we're talking about append to that as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's about these two people who are kind of in conversation, but not.
Mm-hmm.
Two people who basically measure themselves against each other.
Mm-hmm.
And which happens so much in what you do, that idea of sort of like seeing yourself in somebody else's eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if that was one of the things you liked about that. I mean, but also two guys who are incapable of really connecting with other
yeah.
people.
Yeah, I certainly felt that recognition between them.
And we say it's
about Bobby Fischer and his struggle with his madness, really, even as he was becoming, you know, the greatest who ever lived in his field as a chess champion, and about Boris Spassky, who was his kind of Moriarty, this Russian champion, and it's about their relationship really as well, and I just felt that it was such a leap for these two men as the avatars of their societies that were polar opposites to finally reach some moment of understanding and clarity, that would be a real challenge for a story, but also metaphorical to what was happening in the world at the time, which had to do with, you know, the Cold War.
But also, too, again, that idea of people who in some ways almost don't exist unless there's somebody else there.
Mm-hmm.
As kind of a distorted mirror image. And that happens so often in these pieces.
Yeah, I guess Blood Diamond has a little bit of that too, with sure. the character that DiCaprio plays with Jaimin Hansu.
Hansu, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. What I'm trying to think back on really are what are those movies that might have given me that inspiration, or where did I take that
out of
drama, you know, from the theater? You know, I mean, every filmmaker obviously relates to Lawrence of Arabia. And those relationships are not dissimilar to what you're talking about, really. I think I'm thinking sometimes of some of the Westerns that were, you know, very laconic, this kind of two men.
Almost the Bud Bedecker Westerns of the 1950s.
Yeah, something like that. But also I was thinking of like Jean-Pierre Melville and some of those French movies of these people in this circumstance, or even some of the prisoner of war movies Stalag 17 or The Great Escape or those kind of movies, which were very important when I was really young.
These movies you are talking about relate to what you do because they're epic films that are finally about the intimate.
Yes, I think that's true.
And because I guess I always find myself was wondering if it was maybe Bertolucci or something like some of the Italian films of the 60s that are kind of about this sort of thing too.
Yeah, it's funny. One of the movies that I most loved was We All Loved Each Other So Very Much.
Oh, gosh, sure.
It was a Torrescola.
Yeah.
That's about three men, not two, but it is indeed about those sort of relationships as they grow and as they
change. About that kind of loneliness and not existing really without the other person as a way to sort of define yourself. And that's what it comes down to.
You know, it's also interesting to me, and it just occurs to me, there is something about a movie star that is essentially lonely.
How do you mean?
I think that movie stars are often understood to be self-contained. And I think that's one of the things they offer. Now, if I think of some of the great movie stars, I think of Steve McQueen, and I think of Brando, and I think they had there's a certain screw you to the world, and that I'm fine, and I'm going to continue, and I go from this movie to this movie with that sort of persona intact. I'm untouchable in some fundamental way.
Is that a conversation you're able to have with these actors in some way? I mean, can you? I mean, not without putting, not basically.
No, I think not. I think it's best not to.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Because it's you're asking for a result then, and I'm classic enough in my sort of idea of what directing the actor is not to try to ask for a result.
Well, it's interesting too because you think about that way. It's almost the antithesis of what so much. What we think about from movies which are very goal-oriented, I mean, these things you were talking about, The Great Escape or Lawrence of Arabia, are about heroes doing this thing.
Right, but what we really want from movies is to have that window open in behind that movie star's eyes and let us in and have some catharsis as they go through it. We want to cry with them and go along with them. And I think that's the one thing they also do is they invite you finally. They keep you out and they keep you out, and then there's a moment in which they somehow let you in. I think about Denzel and some of the things I've done with him and his ability to do that, to seem untouchable and impervious to deep, deep vulnerability. What that does at that moment when you finally get that, how that feels.
And those breakdowns he have, some like Courage Under Fire or The Siege, those moments are often by him alone.
That's true. And by the way, this movie has a very interesting equivalent of that, I think, about this man in this circumstance.
Yeah, that's what I was talking about, again, seeing him in that jail cell. When you brought that up, it just becomes something to talk about. That idea of people often having these sorts of moments of awareness when they're alone.
Yeah.
And understanding about themselves when they're alone.
Do you remember the Brissell movie, A Condemned Man?
Oh, sure. Oh,
yeah,
gosh, yeah.
That occurs
a
to
man
me,
condemned.
Too.
Yeah. Gosh, there's always so much to talk with you about here. And even in the comedies, I mean, the interior is loneliness in these things, about people wanting to connect and not really being able to. I mean, we're having the conversation with you about Love and Other Drugs and just about that core of loneliness being something you were able to play for comedy as well as drug.
Well, I mean, I am interested in that struggle that we all have, that notion of being alone fundamentally, and how we reach out to connect to other people, and how hard that is, and what that feels like when you finally do, and what are the rewards to be gotten from it. And I think this story actually falls into that category.
And we're out of time, as we always are. It's always so good to have you here. Thank you so much, Ed. Thank you.
It's really fun. Thank you.
My guess is we're still fighting after all these years. Edward Zwick, his new film, his director, is Trial by Fire, recording engineer here at NPR. This is Patrick Murray. The show is mixed by Kat Yoris, edited by Blake Veit, who's associate producer. I clearly need a friend. It's The Treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.